May or may not be aware that up until recently, I was with Radioactive Radio San Diego doing a show called Doing Time Behind the Bars of America. Today's show is dedicated to the Green Scare and Mamiya Abu-Jamal, featuring lots of great music and an audio prison recording, or a couple of audio prison recordings by Mamiya Abu-Jamal, taken from the website prisonradio.org, which is run by Noel Hanrahan. And I don't know whether people are aware or not, but Mamiya Abu-Jamal is on death row. I'll be reading an article about him later. But basically, his last appeal is coming up, and there will be directions later on in the show about how you can help to keep him off death row. A very talented journalist who was framed up by the police and has spent years on death row. Just a bit of an introduction about the show. Today is my second show. On a regular basis, Behind the Bars of America will give regular political prisoner updates, provide listeners with information about upcoming events, discuss occupied territory, colonisation, and imperialism. Rob Ruckus also has an amazing talent for working out CD compilations. So he will bring to us also some wonderful music, which is very pertinent to the topics raised today, and on all days, actually. Conferences and protests will also be aired and covered live. The Patriot Act, police brutality, and the prison industrial complex will be frames of reference throughout the show on an ongoing basis. So it's going to be really political. What's going to happen? No. Women in prison, black communities, both in prison and out, who are grossly underrepresented in the mainstream media, will be given a voice. Music and do-it-yourself CDs will be promoted. Political, social, prisoner updates will be aired. And so, as I was saying before, this show is dedicated to the Green Scare. Before we go into some music, and there will be some articles later on, I wanted to actually just provide a definition of the Green Scare. To oppose the new war on dissent is really important, isn't it? December the 7th was a day of solidarity with Green Scare inductees and political prisoners. The following is taken from a website called www.greenscare.org and is perfectly appropriate for today's show dedication. The term Green Scare refers to the Red Scares of the early 20th century, made famous by the McCarthy hearings and the House Un-American Activities Committee. The Green Scare demonstrates a similar systematic criminalisation of dissent as the US government is using all its tactics, for example, grand juries, specialised legislation, paid agents to target the radical environmental and animal rights movements, those who publicly support them and others who struggle for a healthy, diverse ecosystem and the rights of animals. On December the 7th, 2005, the FBI made their first arrests of Operation Backfire, a multi-state sweep targeting alleged Earth Liberation and Animal Liberation Front activists, with charges of conspiracy and arson, threatening them with life in prison. Elsewhere, the government has convicted organisers of the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty Shack campaign, a campaign that ultimately kept HLS off the stock market and can take credit for the divestment of hundreds of their clients and investors. The Shack Seven are currently serving up to 6 years for violating the Animal Enterprise Protection Act by operating a website. In Sacramento, Eric McDavid, waiting in solitary confinement for trial, faces up to 20 years of alleged thought crime, for alleged thought crime, I should say. In 2001, Jeffrey was convicted of damaging three sports utility vehicles that were later restored and sold. He is currently serving his 6th year of a 22-year, 8-month sentence. I think rapists and pedophiles get less. This year, on December 7th, people all over the country will be organising and participating in events to raise awareness about the Green Scare and show solidarity with those targeted by them. Today's show is a remembrance of December 7th. I would like to make clear that on December 7th just passed, hundreds of solidarity events were planned all over America and elsewhere. On today's show, activists targeted by the Green Scare will be documented, and Daniel McGowan will be one of those people discussed. Stay tuned to killradio.org for this and more. For now, sit back and listen to Mamiya Abu-Jamal and some great music to follow, and we may even hear some stuff by Judy Barrie as well.
Can you hear me? against memory, the Bloxon Collection. For folks who dwell beyond the boundaries of Philadelphia, perhaps the name Charles L. Bloxon is unknown. In Philadelphia, his name is almost as familiar as Ben Franklin's, for he has labored for long decades to research, publish, collect, and teach black history. It would hardly be an exaggeration to say that he was born an historian, for his lifelong fascination with history began when he was but a child, not far from his 10th year of life. It would be sweet to suggest that a loving history teacher lit the flames of learning, but that would be misleading. In fact, he was in school, but as the only black child in a class in Norristown, Montgomery County, right outside of Philadelphia, Bloxon recalls asking his teacher why she never mentioned Negroes in her recounting of the nation's history. She replied simply that Negroes had no history to recount. The boy burned at her words, for he recalled the stories of his father, his grandfather, and his uncles, who told him about the glorious Underground Railroad, which he later verified with prodigious research. Bloxon is today not just an acclaimed historian and researcher, but a committed bibliophile or book lover, whose collection includes a book published in 1557, and indeed original copies of such black classics as David Walker's Appeal and The Confessions of Nat Turner. Today, the Charles L. Bloxon Afro-American Collection is held at Temple University, and it is the fifth largest such collection in the U.S. Because Temple U plans to ship it to a smaller site, Bloxon and other renowned Temple scholars like Molefi Asante, Tony Montero, and Lynn Washington, and scholar activists from other schools are in full protest. Bloxon's own writings, among them Black Genealogy, The Underground Railroad, dramatic first-hand accounts of daring escapes to freedom, and African Americans in Pennsylvania, are gold mines of history, showing how deeply wrong was this elementary school teacher and how central black history is to the very notion of American freedom. That struggle, like the local struggle to treat his vast collection of Afro-Americana with respect, is yet unresolved. Temple, for its part, is a huge entity which swallows whole neighborhoods like a metropolitan Pac-Man. It's used to taking, not giving. But like the great Frederick Douglass once opined, power concedes nothing without demand. In a city where black life is being made more and more tenuous, more troubled, who will struggle for yesterday? The answer to that question will determine this struggle and others. If I suggested that the Bloxon Afro-American collection at Temple only held books, then I may have misled you. The shawl once worn by the revered Harriet Tubman, known as General Moses, for her heroic deeds to free hundreds of her people in the Underground Railroad, is in this collection. And from America's hidden corners, there is a book within that is a silent testament of the way things were. It is a book bound with the skin of a black man who was lynched. The original letters of Marcus Garvey, Paul Robeson, abolitionist William Still are within this collection. It has the largest assembly of jazz music and complete editions of black publications like Jet, Ebony, the Philadelphia Tribune, and the like. History is as ancient as memory and as recent as this morning. In December 2006, Charles L. Bloxon, now moving into his 70s, is set to retire. Yet he proclaims, "I'm not going anywhere." It seems the fight for history is never really over. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Do it. Me don't dip on nobody's side. Me don't dip on the black man's side, not the white man's side. Me dip on God's side.
And you're back with killradio.org. And that was actually Soulfly off their first LP. And the song was called Prejudice. And I'm here to read a couple of articles now. The first article is about the Green Scare. The show is dedicated to the Green Scare. In case people have just tuned in, this is killradio.org. And there's a couple of things that I want to read out. There's another article about Mumia Abu-Jamal, which I'll be reading out as well. And the first article is called Flames of Dissent, the Local Spark that Ignited an Eco-Sabotage Boom and Bust. And it's by Kira Abraham. And here is the beginning of the article. The dog's barking punctuated a steady bang, bang, bang on the front door. It was 7 a.m. and Heather Coburn was not in the mood for this. She swung open the door to encounter dark-suited federal agents who informed her that they wanted to talk to her about her housemate, Jake Ferguson. When she refused, they flashed a search warrant and said they were going to tow her truck. It was spring 2001, a peak time in Eugene's eco-radical scene. The vandalism at the fall 1999 WTO protests summarily blamed on Eugene anarchists and the rowdy anti-establishment protests that followed, confrontations between black-clad anarchists and cops, broadcast by a pulse of locally based radical green media, had catapulted this damp little city to international infamy. Some of the more extreme activists were calling for revolution against earth-raping corporations and the government by any means necessary, and a surge of arsons claimed by the Earth and Animal Liberation Fronts told the world that they were serious. The obsessively secretive eco-sabotage had eluded federal agents for years, but the mystery of Coburn's truck presented a crack in the case. Over the next 5 years, through grand jury subpoenas, informants and the threat of life sentences, federal agents would wrestle that crack ever wider. Eventually, 12 environmentalists would plead guilty to conspiracy and arson, their faces for so long masked, exposed to the world in the unforgiving greys of newspaper ink. About a week before her FBI wake-up call, Coburn had discovered that her truck was missing from its usual spot outside her North Grand Street house. She'd had a nasty fight with Ferguson the night before, accusing him of pitting his multiple lovers against one another. "He was hostile and trashed my house and moved out," she said. "I woke up the next morning and my car was gone." Assuming Ferguson had ganked her truck, Coburn called the police and reported the truck stolen. By the time an EPD officer arrived, she had found her truck parked a block away and told him to forget about it. That same day, upon advice from her friend, she filed a restraining order against Ferguson. What she didn't realise was that on the night before, eco-radicals had torched more than 30 SUVs at Romania. Well, that's actually questionable. I'm not sure who wrote this article, but anyway, I'm reading out this article not to condemn, but to actually give listeners a picture of what is actually happening. The same dealership that Jeff Free and Craig Critter Marshall had burned the year before. That morning also happened to mark the start of Jeff's trial. Some of Coburn's friends were furious with her for going to the cops, suspicious that she told them too much. One woman, an activist called Sparrow, went to the police station and asked for both a report and the restraining order. According to statements made by retired EPD Chief Thad Bookman, Rolling Stone, Sparrow's inquiry helped police connect Coburn's truck to Ferguson and Ferguson to the arsons. Just an editor's note here. This is actually all alleged, so we don't actually know whether these people did commit arson, but it's just basically, as I said, some background to the case. Buckman did not return EW's calls. When Coburn and her boyfriend Tabuse went to pick up the truck in the Gateway Mall area, FBI agents handed them both grand jury subpoenas. Coburn didn't like the idea of grand juries, which force people to testify in secret proceedings without a lawyer in order to indict a suspect. But she had just gotten a big grant from the city to do permaculture projects in Whittaker, and she knew that if she refused to testify, she could end up incarcerated for contempt. It's really interesting how this article really highlights how the FBI use the vulnerabilities of activists and workers such as this. So she had to testify before the grand jury because of her grant, because she was afraid to lose her grant. Heather wasn't willing to make that sacrifice. "The grand jury testimony wasn't so bad or even so revealing," Coburn said. but many of her friends, who hated nothing so much as law enforcement, would never forgive her for it. I felt really persecuted by the community, she said. People I don't even know labelled me a snitch because I wouldn't go to jail rather than go to the grand jury. In an effort to be open, Coburn went to the house info shop and offered an eco-anarchist filmmaker a play-by-play of her grand jury experience. She told him that there had been names about Ferguson, SUVs and relationships with certain people, but she really didn't think anything would come of it. Sure, her friends were radicals and they could act stupid at times, but not so stupid as to commit arson, she figured. More subpoenas followed Coburn. Ferguson was ordered to appear before the grand jury, but he consulted with a court-appointed lawyer and skipped out to New Orleans for a few months. Another activist, Carla, was served a subpoena in fall 2001 and announced that she would not testify. About 3 years later, the grand jury re-subpoenaed her, and this time she complied. Around May 2004, FBI Special Agent John Ferrilla showed up at the home of eco-activist Jennifer Woodruff, who has a son with Ferguson, and served her a grand jury subpoena. Arson's wrong, and we think you can help us, she remembers him saying. Woodruff, then 31 years old, with tattoos on her hands and long dark hair, told Faria that she wouldn't testify. But internally, she was scared of jail, of being taken away from her son. When the feds offered to interview her with two other activist women with their lawyers present rather than alone before the grand jury, Woodruff initially agreed. Still, a sense of impending betrayal kept her awake at night, and on the day she was scheduled to testify, she told her lawyer she'd changed her mind. I can't give in to those bastards, she thought. She remembers federal prosecutor Kirk Ingle threatening to have her jailed for contempt. I never heard from them again, she said, but her son's dad, Jake Ferguson, did. By 2003, he was strung out on heroin, playing heavy metal guitar, eat shit, fuck face, and whatever. I don't know why they're being so graphic in this article. Rob Ruckus.
Yo.
I need your help here.
What?
This article here, it seems very questionable, doesn't it? Can you just shed some light on what I'm reading here? I just want to be a bit analytical on the show for a bit.
Don't know. It's, a bit graphic on that. It's definitely questionable about what's going on. It seems like there's just not a clear story of what happened.
There's not, and so really that's really what symbolizes the green scare, doesn't it? Because so many sweeping speculations are being made about all these activists that committed arsons. What do you think that's about? What do you think the criminalizing of dissent is about?
Well, it's in regards to terrorism. It's definitely that their program is not necessarily to stop terrorism, but to stop people who has the potential to commit a terrorist, as they have defined it here in America as domestic terrorism or environmental terrorism. Basically, that qualifies anybody who speaks out against the regime or gives an opinion that may be considered a threat. A very thin line.
And yet, 11 activists, more than 11 activists, were arrested for arson. I mean, I find this really interesting. How do we know that it wasn't developers that did this? Anyway, continue on with the article. I've actually skipped over a lot of it. In December 2005, the feds swooped in for the bust, arresting William Rogers, Kevin Tubbs, Standila Smallfall, Chelsea Cooler, Kendall Tanksley, and Daniel McGowan. They also jailed Darren Thurston on immigration charges. He would later be indicted for arson. In January 2006, they arrested Southern Oregon residents Suzanne Savoy and Jonathan Paul. In February and March, Joanna and Nathan Block and Brianna Waters, all from Olympia, Washington. By April, they had also indicted Josephine Sunshine, Rebecca, Joseph and Justin, who are still at large. At some point during the sweep, spokesman natives Jennifer Collar and Lacey came forward to cooperate, according to the FBI. Federal prosecutors minced no words, calling the defendants eco-terrorists, which is what Rob Ruckus was talking about, and threatening them with staggering post-9/11 style sentences. Faced with that terrible decision, rat out your friends or sit in jail until you die, each defendant, it seems, reacted differently. Mefor reportedly started cooperating immediately. Tubbs, Savoy, Gulach, Thurston and Tanksley had made the same decision by the time they pleaded guilty in July. So did Kohler and Philibum, who pleaded guilty in October. While snitch provisions have not been made public, virtually all such deals require cooperating defendants to name names, according to Civil Liberties Defence Centre attorney Lauren Regan. And she's actually done some wonderful work in relation to this, who lived with Philbin for a year. Four defendants before the federal court in Oregon, McGowan, Paul, Block and Zaka, pleaded not guilty. On behalf of all four, the team of defence attorneys filed discovery motions asking the feds to hand over any information that had been obtained through National Security Administration surveillance or warrantless wiretaps, which a judge had recently ruled illegal. The federal prosecutors stalled, pushing back their court-ordered deadline three times while maintaining that no illegal surveillance had occurred. But eventually they struck a plea deal with the defendants. In exchange for withdrawing the discovery motion and confessing to their own crimes, all four defendants would get dramatically reduced sentences and would not have to implicate anyone else. They took the deal, pleading guilty in November. Only one defendant, Brianna Waters, continues to plead not guilty before the federal court in Washington. Her attorney is pursuing a discovery motion similar to that filed by the Oregon defense team. Hanging like a pall over the community is the knowledge that Rogers had made an entirely different decision. Alone in his jail cell in Flagstaff, Arizona, in December 2005, he had scrawled two notes, one bemoaning his betrayal and the other addressed to his friends and family. In a sec we'll actually go into some music. This article is pretty graphic, but I read it out because I felt like it was really important that listeners gained an idea about the backlash and the suffering and the persecution that activists go through. Just to give a clear-cut example, Jeff Free, who's behind bars as we speak, was convicted of torching an SUV. Now, he was convicted under Measure 11 and got years in prison. I think he would have got about 22 years. When no one was harmed, there was very little property destruction, and in fact, the SUV was sold, I think, in the end. So, yeah, it's very interesting the way that is. I think before I read about Mumia Abu-Jamal, we'll go into some more music.
Actually, we're going to hear another complimentary, another audio piece by Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's talking about the recent shooting that happened by the undercover cops in New York City. It was another incident of being non-white in public.
No safe age. It's boys' night out, and a group of brothers are having a bachelor's party at a strip club. One of them is particularly thrilled because his marriage to the woman he loves is just hours away. But he will never marry because a pack of wild undercover cops will execute him and unleash a deadly rain of 50 bullets on him and his friends. The crime? Cruising while black. Sean Bell, unarmed, is 23. And the corporate media merely explains it may have been a case of contagious shooting. One cop fires, two cops fire, three cops. Get the picture? It's a kind of social illness like alcoholism. But neither Sean Bell, Trent Benefield, nor Joseph Guzman were armed. According to some reports, one of the men said he was armed. Like the madmen who launched a preemptive war on the unsubstantiated suspicion of weapons of mass destruction, undercover cops launched an urban war on unarmed black men, reportedly based on unsubstantiated suspicions, 50 shots, death, and serious injury. No cell phones, no wallets, no candy bars, for such trifles are no longer deemed necessary. In America, blackness is sufficient. Even maleness isn't required. as shown by the recent shooting of an elderly woman who allegedly allowed a drug dealer to use her home. The woman, having lived almost 9 decades, was shot to death while trying to defend her home after it was attacked by undercover cops. According to a neighborhood snitch, he never claimed her house was a drug site, despite police pressure to do so. No significant quantities of drugs were found at the home. What was her crime? Trying to survive to 90 while black? What's more dangerous, drugs or armed undercover cops kicking in doors allegedly on a drug raid? How many of these armed maniacs will ever see the inside of a cell? How many will reach the confines of death row? We know the answer because we've seen this movie before. Paid leave, which amounts to paid vacation, a whitewash of an investigation, and they were just doing their jobs is all that ever happens. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Suspicious activity.
And you're back with killradio.org, and I'm really just warming up to my subject of the Green Scare. And remember that we are in occupied territory, and where you're immediately always being called a terrorist, whether you've committed a crime or not. You don't actually have to be to commit a crime to become a target of the state. And that's the sort of stuff that we really do need to remember. The song that you just heard was by Jello Biafra and the Melvines. It's their first album together. And I think the album is called Only Breathe What You Can See. And the title of the song is called McGruff the Crime Dog, which I think basically talks about snitches and stuff like that, if I'm not mistaken. I'm going to read now an article about Mumia Abu-Jamal. Before I do that, I just wanted to let you know that towards the end that Rob Ruckus will be plugging a radio benefit that's coming up at killradio.org on the 18th of January at the Echo. And there are some really cool bands that are going to be playing at this benefit, and we'll give the location and everything, so keep listening so that you can hear all those details. And if you're lucky, you might even be able to hear some songs, individual songs that you're played, that are played by those bands. So here is the article about Mumia Abu-Jamal. Pennsylvania Abu-Jamal case goes to Third Circuit. Prosecutor admits Jamal had no true defence. By Dave Lindorf, Buzzflash. That's the name of the paper. It's been 25 years now since Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner was shot dead in a Center City, Philadelphia, red light district. Since then, Faulkner has become a rallying point and the nation's death penalty advocates. It's been 25 years, too, since the man convicted of killing Faulkner, Philadelphia radio journalist and former Black Panther, Mumia Abu-Jamal, was arrested for the crime at the scene. Since July 1982, Abu-Jamal has been in solitary confinement on Philadelphia. Abu-Jamal has been has become a world-famous prison journalist and a rallying point for those opposed to capital punishment. The debates over Abu-Jamal's guilt or innocence have raged now for an astonishing quarter of a century. Through the presidencies of Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. And here's my favourite. Battles have raged too within the loose-knit group of people who have backed Abu-Jamal, between those who argue that he is an innocent man, a political prisoner condemned for his politics, and those who simply argue that he never received a fair trial. Politicians at the local, state, and even federal level, many without any real knowledge about this complex case, have prostituted themselves by pressing for Abu-Jamal's execution, while others, sometimes equally ignorant of the facts, have lionized him and honored him with honorary citizenships and street names. Whatever one's views on this case, however, the reality is, for the first time in 25 years, Abu-Jamal is finally going to get a chance in the second highest court in the land to make the case that his 1982 trial was fatally tainted by unconstitutional error, judicial bias, race bias, jury selection, and prosecutorial misconduct. The reality also is that the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which will be hearing arguments on Abu-Jamal's appeal early next year, barring any unanticipated delays, could conceivably end up ordering a new trial for Abu-Jamal, a trial that, because of better defence counsel, a changed political climate, shifting demographics, the deaths of some witnesses, and the likelihood of new defence witnesses, would most likely end up setting him free or having him released for time served. At the same time, the same three-judge panel hearing this appeal will also be considering a counter-appeal by the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, which seeks to overturn a lower federal district court decision, which 5 years ago tossed out Abu-Jamal's death sentence. So at the same time that the Third Circuit could end up giving Abu-Jamal a new chance to prove his innocence, or at least to leave prison a free man, it could ironically also end up sending him back onto death row and to a date with the needle. Let's look at the DA's appeal first, since it's fairly simple. In 2001, Judge William Yon, a former county state judge appointed to the federal bench by the first President Bush, found that Abu-Jamal's death sentence had been constitutionally tainted. He ruled that the instructions of the trial judge, the late Albert Sabot, and the jury polling form used by Sabot were both confusing and could have led jurors to mistakenly assume that they could not consider any mitigating circumstances, which might argue against a death sentence unless all 12 members of the jury agreed that such a mitigating factor existed. In fact, as Judge Yon noted in his decision, the law allows any one juror who finds such a mitigating factor, for example, being a devoted father to a young child or having a difficult childhood, to consider that factor in deciding whether or not to vote for a death penalty. Since the law requires a unanimous vote for death in order for a capital sentence to be imposed, this means that any one juror should be able to take execution off the table if she or he thinks there is a sufficiently mitigating factor. If the DA can convince at least two of the three appellate judges that Yon was wrong in his ruling, Abdul-Jamal would be put back on death row with his only remaining hope of avoiding execution being the US Supreme Court or a reversal of his conviction itself. Even if the Third Circuit supports Yon's overturning of the death sentence, however, Abdul-Jamal could still end up facing execution. This is because once an appeals court decision is rendered, the DA will have 180 days to decide whether to seek a new trial on the sentence alone. If that were to happen, a new jury would have to be impaneled to hear arguments for and against execution, with the alternative being life in prison without possibility of parole. Yon's vacating of Abdul-Jamal's death sentence was well-reasoned, and it seems unlikely that the higher court would reverse it. But this case has been full of surprises from the start, with most of them going against Abdul-Jamal, so it cannot be ruled out. Meanwhile, however, this past year there was a surprise ruling by the Third Circuit that went Abdul-Jamal's way and that improved his chances of winning a new trial by 200%. That surprise came in the form of an announcement that Abdul-Jamal would be allowed to add two additional grounds for appeal of his conviction to the one, which Judge Yon had already certified for appeal. Under existing law and federal court rules, a capital defendant is only guaranteed the right to appeal to the federal appellate court a ruling that a lower federal district judge has certified for appeal. Petitions to consider other issues may be made to appellate judges, but those appeals judges have no obligation to grant a hearing on them. In Abdul-Jamal's case, Judge Yon rejected all 20 of his appeals of his conviction, but on one of those claims, the argument that his jury had been systematically stripped of qualified black jurors by the prosecutor's use of pemmimary challenges for which no reason has to be given, the judge seemed troubled enough by the evidence presented that he certified an appeal to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Abdul-Jamal's appellate attorney, Robert R. Bryan of San Francisco, went ahead and pursued several other rejected grounds for appeal, though, and was rewarded last December with a decision by the Third Circuit to hear appeals arguments on two other grounds. One of these was the claim the prosecutor, Joseph McGill, near the trial's end during his summation to the jury, had improperly led jurors to believe they needn't worry about the possibility of wrongfully convicting the defendant. Turning the basic requirement that jurors may only convict if they feel a case has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, McGill instead urged Abdul-Jamal's jury to go ahead and vote guilty because their verdict would not be the last word. McGill, a veteran prosecutor who clearly knew what he was doing, improperly assured them without any objection from the judge that there would be appeal after appeal of their verdict, which he argued, therefore, may not be final. Federal courts are generally found unconstitutional such attempts to remove jurors' sense of responsibility for the gravity of their decision. It is hard to imagine how fair-minded appellate judges could allow such a blatant undermining of the law to stand, and yet there have been many examples of appeals courts doing just this, and the Abdul-Jamal case is a very politically charged issue. The other ground for appeal, which the Third Circuit invited an appeal filing on in the charge, was a charge that Judge Sabot had been unconstitutionally biased against the defendant both at the original trial and during the 1995 Post-Conviction Relief Act hearing. A few years back, Abdul-Jamal's defence team discovered a court stenographer, Terry Mira Carter, who said that in the opening days of Abdul-Jamal's trial, she, in the company of her own judge, Richard Clean, currently a state superior court judge, had overheard Sabot say he would help them fry the nigger. The alleged incident reportedly occurred at the end of the day as Sabo was exiting the courtroom along with his court clerk through the private robing room exit, just as Judge Clean, then a civil court judge who was planning to borrow Sabo's courtroom that evening for evening hearings, and his stenographer was entering the room. Common Pleas Judge Pamela Demby in 2001 ruled that it wouldn't matter if Sabo had uttered those words since this was a jury trial. Hers was a bizarre decision, since even if jurors, not judges, render the verdict, judges clearly do make critical decisions about the admissibility of evidence, about the questions that may be asked of witnesses, and about how trials are to be conducted, and it's common sense that a biased judge could easily skew a trial against a defendant. But in any event, in a PCRA hearing where there is no jury, it is the judge alone who determines whether new evidence is significant, what questioning will be allowed of witnesses, and what subpoenas will be issued on behalf of the defendant. So basically, this article really does highlight that this is not only a politically charged trial, but there is blatant racism and misconduct by the prosecution towards Mumia Abdul-Jamal. In case people have tuned in, you're with killradio.org, and I'm reading an article about a famous political prisoner and journalist, radio journalist, Mumia Abdul-Jamal, and this show is dedicated to the Green Scare. So there is an appeal being planned for him, another appeal in the Third Circuit Court. I don't think a date has yet been created, but I will certainly bring you news on this show, Behind the Bars of America. But for now, I think we have more music.
Actually, we're going to go into a piece about Judy Berry, who was actually a victim of the FBI, where they planted a bomb inside of her car. Yes, bombings. You hear a lot in the news talking about how there's a lot of violence that's happening in countries like Iraq and so on. But don't forget, we are within the occupying forces of the most powerful, wealthiest, and largest terrorist organization known as America. Bombings conducted by state officials and government officials against citizens who dare to not just trying to stop or halt the agendas of the government, but trying to correct environmental wrongdoings by a corporation. Here's a piece by Judy Berry that talks about that happened back in 1990 in May.
She's dead now. Not from the bomb, but from breast cancer.
Going to play songs and show a slideshow and show a slideshow and recruit for a Redwood Summer slideshow and recruit for a Redwood Summer among the college students there. Redwood Summer slideshow songs where we were two and we were on tonight. It was the bomb exploded. It was May 24th, 1990, and we were on our way to a concert in Santa Cruz where we were going to play songs and show a slideshow and recruit for a Redwood Summer among the college students there. I can't even describe how horrible it was. I can tell you I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe. But the horror of this experience didn't end with the bombing itself, because within minutes of the bombing, the FBI terrorist squad from the San Francisco FBI office was on the scene. And I literally mean this, within minutes, certainly within a half hour. According to their own records, the first record we have of their being on the scene is a log by the Oakland police. And 25 minutes after the bomb explodes, they recount their conversations with the FBI agents. So they were there pretty fast, considering that this was in Oakland and that FBI office is in San Francisco. And what the FBI did, arriving on the scene immediately, actually my lawyer wrote in the brief, the FBI was there in a trice, almost as if they had been standing around the corner holding their ears. But at any rate, they, whether or not they were standing around the corner holding their ears, they were certainly there quickly, and what they did was they quickly kind of took control of the scene. And they talked to the Oakland police, who were the responding agency. And what they did is they said to the Oakland police, they said, we know these people. These people are terrorists. And literally what they said, this was testified by Sergeant Sitterud of the Oakland police. He said, they told us that these were the kind of people who would carry a bomb. They told us that these people, in fact, qualified as terrorists. So with that, the Oakland police were a lot more willing to, they have a long relationship with the FBI anyway, certainly going back to the days of the Black Panthers, and with this stuff being told to them by the FBI, they were willing to cooperate. But it's not just that they, you know, accidentally thought that I bombed myself. What we've found is that they told some very, very deliberate lies. And you can't really excuse the Oakland police for going along with it, because these lies were so obvious that anybody with a set of eyes in their head could have seen them. First thing they said, and this was from FBI Special Agent Frank Doyle, and Frank Doyle was their bomb expert on the terrorist squad. And it actually says in the warrant for our actually the search warrant, where there's a warrantless arrest, so there is no arrest warrant. So the reasons for the arrest are laid out in the search warrant. And what it says in there is it says, the Oakland police say, I viewed the bombed car along with Special Agent Frank Doyle of the FBI. Frank Doyle informed me that the bomb was on the backseat floorboard, and therefore they should have seen it, and therefore they knew that they were carrying it. Well, years later, as this lawsuit has progressed, we've gotten hold of the Oakland police's own photos. Now, the place where Frank Doyle testified the bomb was right where you put your feet when you're sitting in the back seat. And this, of course, is under the seat. And any idiot could see this. I mean, Ray Charles could see this. You don't have to be a bomb expert to see that this bomb was not in the back seat. So at that point began an incredible press smear. From the moment that this bomb went off, went an incredible press smear nationwide. It's the only time we ever made the front page of the New York Times. And what this press smear was to tell people that we were terrorists who had blown ourselves up with our own bomb. And this, although we can't get anything that we actually do, we can't get it in the newspapers, this one got picked up all over the place. And there were selected leaks and innuendos given out by the FBI and the Oakland police in order to convince people that not only are we violent terrorists who carry bombs around in our car, but we're stupid violent terrorists who carry them under our own car seat.
I heard a crack, and then my whole head started to ring like a sitar in my head, like, and the car came to a screeching halt. The first thought in my mind was, oh no, not again, because last August we had been rear-ended by a log truck without ever seeing it coming, and here we are again, me and Judy in a car, and then I heard somebody scream out, it's a bomb. There was a bomb. And then it all made sense that someone had tried to kill us.
I'm actually pretty sick. I'm not here for the fun of it. I was pretty badly injured. I have 4 breaks in my pelvis. My coccyx bone is crushed. I have limited feeling in my leg, and I don't know the extent to which it will recover. I have to be here in this hospital on my back for a total of 8 weeks, after which I have to begin rehabilitation to try to learn to walk again or whatever I'm going to be able to do. And I'm not going to be able to participate very much in either the organizing or the activities of Redwood Summer.
The cause of the false arrest was our environmental work. I mean, as Lieutenant Sims of the Oakland Police said in the testimony, this wasn't a carload of nuns that a bomb blew up in as it was driving through Oakland. It was because we were Earth First activists that we were targeted to be discredited. So that's the first way that I would connect it. But the second is in the results. I think that the fact that we filed this lawsuit has really had already a chilling effect on the FBI. We organized this year a huge civil disobedience, 1,033
23 people arrested in one day. We had two solid months of just kick-ass actions after that. Day after day, over 250 people arrested. Nobody got death threats. Nobody sent out fake press releases. No bombs exploded in anybody's cars. And I think that the fact that these conditions are lessened. I mean, I'm not going to say that there isn't any harassment of us, because there certainly is. I'm not going to say that there isn't any disruption, because there certainly is. But it's on a very different level than it was in 1990. And I think that this lawsuit is a lot of the reason why, as long as they're under the scrutiny of the public eye, they can't get away. That's why they're a spy agency. You know, that's why they're called spooks. If people are watching them, they can't get away with it. And that's what I think this lawsuit has done.
Chainsaws killing the trees, destroying everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run, but there's nowhere to go when the job is done. How can we stand by while this all takes place? We've got to stop this inhuman race. Mountains by the ton, digging up the uranium, bald eagle looking for a place to land.
rise in defense of Mother Earth. Earth first. Earth first. Earth first. Earth first. No compromise in defense of Mother Earth.
And you're back with coolradio.org. And in case you've just tuned in, this is Behind the Bars of America, a show that's dedicated to the Green Scare. And if you want to know more about Judy Barry, you just heard some material, a speech made by Judy Barry before she died. She was actually involved in the FBI actually bombed her car. And they won the lawsuit, in fact, but this happened after she died. I just wanted to talk about a defendant by the name of Daniel McGowan. He's an environmental activist, and he's one of the defendants that was charged for arson and is part of the Green Scare, of what's happening in the Green Scare. Daniel is an environmental and social justice activist. He was charged in federal court on many counts of arson, property destruction and conspiracy, all relating to two incidents in Oregon in 2001. Until recently, Daniel was offered two choices by the government: cooperate by informing another people or go to trial and face life in prison. His only real option was to plead not guilty until he could reach a resolution of the case that permitted him to honour his principles. Now, as a result of months of litigation and negotiation, Daniel was able to admit to his role in these two incidents, while not implicating or identifying any other people who might have been involved. The government will seek a sentence of 8 years, while Daniel's lawyers will seek a sentence of no more than 63 months. Daniel has entered into a non-cooperating agreement. And if people want to have a look at the website, they can go to www.supportdaniel.org. There's also an email address if you want to donate money for his defence, and it's friendsofdanielmcg@yahoo.com. Donations, checks or money orders can be made out to Lisa McGowan. And there's a P.O. box. It's called Family and Friends of Daniel McGowan. Address the envelope. P.O. box 106, New York, New York, 10156. And we'll now go into, it's Agnostic Front, I think.
Agnostic Front, a piece off their new album, Another Voice.
And then we'll be dealing with other coverage, won't we?
Yes.
Must be made. courage and vision can still determine their own destiny. They can choose war or peace.
Leading the charge from the protesters' side was a little-known group called the Black Bloc, anarchists who believe in violence and the destruction of property. Black Bloc-inspired violence cost that city $3 million. And it's virtually impossible to control the Bloc.
Do you have any idea who's behind this attack?
They have no leadership. They are just people who get together and decide to up the ante during a protest.
Brought a lot of attention to the issue that everybody was in Seattle for.
You're all going to die down here.
Everyone stay calm.
dominating the entire world as the Umbrella Corporation.
What is your intelligence telling you about the amount of black bloc or violent activity that we could expect?
Now, what do revolutionaries do when they win, huh? When the blood has sunk into the fields and been washed from the streets? When the old flag's been torn down, the old ties broken, the old system thrown away?
And you're back with Behind the Bars of America. You're back with coolradio.org. And we are now going to end Behind the Bars of America, and there will be another show coming up called Herbal Pathways. I'd love to have Herbal Bath, what I was never going to say. That's crazy. Herbal Pathways. Herbal Pathways will be a show to remember because it discusses a lot of the actions and properties of herbs. It talks about conventional medicine, the advantages and disadvantages of conventional medicine and herbal medicine. And it may even advertise a herbal seminar or two. So stay tuned to killradio.org for Herbal Pathways. And from doing time behind the bars of America, it's now goodbye. Herbal Pathways will also be hosted by Blind Chaos and Rob Ruckus. So until our next show, stay safe and stay strong, both in prison and out of prison. And we will be back in 2 weeks' time on a Tuesday at the same time. So take care.
We'll be right back. so why not just get worse? Red alert.
Hello and welcome to Herbal Pathways, and you're with killradio.org. This is DJ Blind Chaos. You just heard a song by Jello Biafra, and I think it's a very appropriate ending to Doing Time Behind the Bars of America. Doing Time Behind the Bars of America is on every 2 weeks on a Tuesday at 12 noon. But now we're going to be talking a lot about herbal medicine and the conventional advantages and disadvantages of orthodox medicine, and also looking at different types of herbs. This is my second show. Last week was an introductory show of Herbal Pathways, and in that particular show last week we talked a lot about the actions, properties and uses of herbs. On an ongoing basis, Herbal Pathways will be discussing the history of herbal medicine. And as we all know, herbal medicine dates back to the traditional cultures of the shamans and the Native Americans, the Aboriginal people over in Australia. And also we can't forget the Eastern Asian herbal medicine cultures as well. And I think now what has tended to happen is that a scientific element has been introduced into these traditional herbal medicines. And often, as I said a couple of weeks ago, that the multinational companies are really taking over healing plants. And it is up to us as a community to make sure that herbal medicine is kept alive so that we can look at preventing disease. Now that the winter's coming up, I wanted to really emphasise yet again another a herbal formula, very simple herbal formula that you can take for the flu or for keeping the immune system. There are many, many products that you can take. I do take herbal seminars. I teach herbal seminars, so if anybody's interested, contact the radio station. And I can give you the number at the end of the show if you want that. But, yeah, there are two products that are really good for flu and flu prevention. The first product you can find in most health food shops. There's a health food shop called Herbs and More. And there are Herbs and More, it's called. There are outlets in Temecula and also one in Marietta. And actually, there is a third one too. You can inquire when you call anyway. And they have echinacea and golden seal tablets. You can also get them get the tablets at Clark's Health Food Store. Now, basically, echinacea is an excellent herb for the immune system, and it helps with blood circulation and also with flu prevention, or if you're in the throes of the flu, if you've got a cold or an upper respiratory infection, it actually helps to boost the immune system and helps with congestion as well. The golden seal is a really excellent accompaniment to echinacea, because golden seal is excellent for liver drainage, and for women it's also really good for cleaning out and detoxifying the uterus. It's good for the mucous membrane of the nose as well, so if people have chronic sinus infections, they can take Golden Seal as well. So that's a really great combo that you can take. And I think you can get about 100 tablets or 200 tablets for $30 or $20. You can also make your own too. And I'll be talking about making herbal tablets later on in these shows that I'm going to be doing. Another really great combination that you can have is it's called Yep Tea, and I talked about this during my introductory show. Yep Tea is a combination of herbs. It's peppermint, elder, and yarrow. Peppermint is an excellent antiseptic herb, and it's really good not only for digestion but also to for the throat as well. Elder is a beautiful, I don't know if anyone's ever seen the elder flowers that come up in spring mostly, but elder is an amazing herb for clearing up congestion and for boosting the immune system. Yarrow is really good for lowering fever, and yarrow is spelt Y-A-R-R-O-W. And to make an infusion of these teas, you just put the kettle on, as I say, in England and Australia. You put the kettle on, mate, and have a cup of tea. you put the kettle on and you make an infusion and you pour boiling water. You would put a teaspoon to a cup into the teapot, and then you would then cover the teapot after you pour the boiling water in and basically strain the liquid after 5 or 10 minutes. And it's actually pretty yummy. Today's show will be focusing on the female reproductive system and looking at ways that a woman can become fertile. So if there are any loved ones listening, husbands or partners or friends of someone who's trying to get pregnant, this is a really good show for you. I'll also be announcing a radio benefit that's going to be coming up for killradio.org and looking at more herbs for the flu as well. But before we do that, I'm going to go into some music.
Thank you.
And you're back with killradio.org. This is Herbal Pathways. And I'm going to now read an article, and it's entitled The Uses of Ginger Root. And that's the common name. The botanical name is spelt Zingiber officinalis. So it's Zingiber officinalis, Officinale, officinale. The article is by Laura Shelton. This article has been produced through the John Bay College Health Information Project, located in Seattle. And the Department of Education has recognized programs in naturopathic medicine and nutrition. I'll just start off with the history of ginger. For thousands of years in China and India, ginger has been used as a stimulant, a diaphoretic, and for gastric complaints. Now, diaphoretic means that the herb makes you sweat. And gastric, as people would be aware, is to do with digestion. Especially flatulent colic, gastritis, which is inflammation of the digestive system, and nausea. Other traditional indications include diarrhea, irregular menses, or irregular menstruation, and bronchitis. So these are all the indications that ginger is used for. So if you've got bronchitis, you can actually get yourself a cup of ginger tea, or they sell ginger tablets. Ginger root is used, and it's an Asian herb, but you can find it almost anywhere now. Topically or externally, ginger has been used as a counter-irritant for conditions such as rheumatism, neuralgia, toothache, and headache. Ginger has been used to improve blood circulation, both orally and topically. Originally from India, ginger was first cultivated and naturalized in the Americas in the 1500s. After being brought here by the Spaniards. Pharmacology. It comes from the family of, I'll spell this, Zingiberaceae. It's a perennial plant, which means that the plant grows for more than a year. It's really hard to grow as well. Ginger produces a simple leafy stem from a white fibrous tuber. The leaf sheaths covering the stem protect lancelet leaves, which may reach 12 inches in length. The whole plant stands 3 to 4 feet with white and purple flowers in spikes. The chemical constituents of ginger root have been identified as 50% starch, 9% protein, 6 to 8% of lipids, and it's got volatile oils, vitamins, and resins. Now, often a lot of the time, what tends to happen in a lot of naturopathic schools is that that ginger and other herbs are really not seen as scientifically. And it's really important to actually work out what the chemical constituents are in each herb and how the herb functions. Because basically the oils in there helps the ginger to be antiseptic. And then you've got obviously the vitamins as well, which help with all manner of things. There have never been any reported side effects, long-term or short-term, nor overdose symptoms in either human or animal studies. Yeah. Modern scientific research. In recent years, the pharmacology of ginger root has been researched further with many interesting findings. Ginger causes a significant decrease in platelet aggregation, more potent than garlic or onion due to its inhibition of acid and furthermore, ginger has been shown to increase liver and serum cholesterol levels in human studies, and it acts as a cardiotonic as well. These studies indicate the use of ginger in atherosclerotic and cardiac diseases. Ginger has significant antioxidant properties, according to the Encyclopedia of Common Natural Ingredients, as well as possible anti-inflammatory actions, which are due to the plant's proteases, which is another chemical constituent. So ginger could be used for treating chronic inflammatory processes like bursitis or muscle inflammation. The uses of ginger most frequently cited in the literature are for gastrointestinal problems. Ginger can also be used, in my experience, to clean out the uterus, and has often been used in formulas to increase fertility. One of the myths in conventional medicine, and indeed a lot of GPs and doctors and gynecologists do not realize that when a woman is trying for pregnancy, that she may have nutritional deficiencies. And often what tends to happen is that if a woman is deficient in vitamins, you know, in relevant vitamins and minerals, and isn't eating a healthy diet, that she is unable to become pregnant for that reason. The uses of ginger most frequently cited in the literature are for gastrointestinal problems. The mechanism of action has not been proven, but ginger may increase gastric motility and absorb neutralizing toxins. Basically, what that's saying is that that ginger detoxifies the body. And I think what tends to happen and why a lot of people get frightened of using herbs is because the literature is so complicated and we do need to be able to interpret the literature to work out what's going on. And just to compare that, our healers and our shamans and our traditional cultures are the ones that really worked a lot with herbs, and they knew instinctively, intuitively, what to eat and what not to eat and what herbs to take and what not to. So it's just really interesting the way it is now, isn't it, that you've got your pharmaceutical companies advocating, for example, steroidal drugs for patients experiencing arthritis, and those steroidal drugs create horrific side effects, whereas the herbs are far healthier and very nutritious. And in fact, while surgery is always excellent for acute conditions, we also have to realise that herbal medicine is used for chronic conditions. Now, chronic obviously means when you have had a disease or a condition for a long period of time. And those conditions such as arthritis and rheumatism and indeed infertility, which can be chronic, are very, very difficult conditions to overcome. And often herbs quietly reverse those conditions and are very gentle. I think now what I'll do is I'll go into a song.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you're back with Herbal Pathways, killradio.org. And you just heard two songs that were a blend of Native American and Aboriginality, Aboriginal Australia, you could say. And the last song in particular is really interesting because it's a song that's taken from a CD compilation made in Arnhem Land up in Northern Australia. Is America up or down? I don't even know. There's no map of America in front of me, but anyway, and these songs were actually created through the cultural aspirations of these beautiful Aboriginal female elders over at Arnhem Land, where, in fact, over in Australia, you need a permit to actually go over there to Arnhem Land. And in the course of these herbal medicine shows, I will be talking quite a lot about Australian Aboriginal herbs and looking at some of the herbs that we can use, and you can grow them in America as well, particularly here in Southern California. Although it's not a tropical climate, you do have a climate for some of the desert herbs that are over in Australia. Now, where was I? Yeah, I was talking about the song, the compilation CD. If people wish to know more about the compilation CD, let me know. Contact me here at the radio station. Hey, Ruckus. What's the phone number here for the radio station? 213-252-0998. So, yeah, if people want to know more about that compilation or want to ask me any questions about herbal medicine, just call me. Blind Chaos. So there you go. Now, basically, yeah, those two songs were, as I said, Native American and Aboriginal stuff. I just wanted to talk about hormones and how a lot of hormonal disturbances, both in men and women, I think, can be caused by a lot of imbalances of the whole system, really. And I think a myth in herbal medicine, of herbal medicine, is that the herbs do nothing. It's all part of the mind. It's not really something that is encouraged, I think, by a lot of hospitals and by a lot of women giving birth, for example. Now, obviously, when a woman gets pregnant, the hormones change. And one of the things that you can really do, which is perfectly safe, is that you can take raspberry leaf tea, which is an amazing strengthening nutritive tea that takes charge of the hormones and actually helps you to not only give birth, but it helps to tone the uterus and to balance the hormones out before you give birth. And raspberry leaf tea can be found in all manner of health food stores. Often it's also really good if you can grow it as well. And I do have a lot of information and material on harvesting and drying herbs. Eventually, what I would really like to do on this show, if I get the listeners, is to be able to have listeners call in either into the radio station or if they wish to contact the station by phone, just to talk about how to prevent certain conditions and looking at different conditions that people have. So I wanted to also emphasize that herbal medicine is about treating the whole person. It's not just about symptom relief. It's not just about pain management. Although a good painkiller that you can have is white willow bark. It's a really excellent herb if you have an inflammatory condition of the back, if you've put your back out working. It's also really good for hangovers as well. If you've been out partying and the next day you've got a really bad headache, during a hangover, you can take white willow bark tea. It's and feverfew. Feverfew is a really good headache herb during a hangover as well. So far in the show, I've really looked at it. It's been a very generalist show so far, I think, hasn't it? And one of the things that I wanted to emphasize as well is that medical care is a right, not a charity. And it's a right, not a privilege. And how many Americans do we hear who cannot get the right treatment or can't get access to the right treatment. How many women do we hear who've had breast cancer, for example, and are waiting on waiting lists to go in and get the treatment that they need because they don't have the medical care. We also have to consider our homeless as well, who a lot of the time don't get access. And often people say, oh, yes, but they're on welfare. Well, hey, in the end, welfare has to be paid back, doesn't it? So, you know, I think there are a lot of inequalities in our medical system here in America. And by people getting educated about herbal medicine, they can then take control of their own lives and drink their teas, you know, and realise that that herbal medicines are also foods as well, that you can actually ingest, you can see it as a food, that it's not just to take when you're sick or when you're feeling sick, but being able to, for example, keep the digestive system clean by taking peppermint, chamomile and lemon balm, which is a wonderful herbal tea formulation that was actually created by a famous German author called Rudolf Weiss, W-E-I-S, and the book is called Herbal Medicine. It has been translated into a lot of languages, including English, and he's a German author. Amazing book. It's got a lot of chapters on the flu. It looks at breast cancer. It looks at digestors, a really excellent chapter on digestion, and it talks very simply and very clearly about herbs. One of the things you're going to discover about me, okay, is that I'm not going to just sit here and give opinions about what I think is important. What we need to do is, I mean, you know, have you ever heard the saying, the proof is in the pudding? Okay, we need to look at our literature. We need to respect our older herbalists. We need to not only look at our literature, but also to be intuitive as well. And I know for a fact that I have provided herbal medicines, and I've got excellent results with that. And I also cured myself of asthma through taking herbal medicine. I was on Ventolin, and I was able to just exercise common sense. And I, in fact, I had a family member that I've been treating with herbs, and he has a really bad back, and all his back spasms have gone simply by taking white willow bark, skullcap, and valerian. So, yeah, I think what I'm trying to do this afternoon is to really introduce to you some common themes that I will be covering on my shows. And the reason, obviously, why it's called Herbal Pathways is because it's following the path to get well, isn't it? That's really what it's doing. Do we have any more music?
Yes, we do.
Okay, we might go into another song. Stay tuned.
Go on, 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 go on
Yeah, and that was a song by Titus, and it's basically a song which is a lullaby that you would sing to your baby, and yeah, it's really quite an amazing CD. Okay, I just wanted to kind of read out an article. It's called Herbs and the Hormones, and it was written by a famous herbalist by the name of Simon Y. Mills. He's written a lot of really good books, and one of them, which I think you need to get your hands on, is called The Complete Guide to Modern Herbalism. So here's some of the article. Hormones are chemicals produced by specialized glands in the body that circulate in the body fluids, exerting considerable influence on the functions of all the body's tissues and cells. There are many different hormones known so far, and almost certainly many more that await discovery. Each hormone is like a chemical radio beam, sent out from its transmitting station to glands like the adrenal cortex, thyroid, pituitary, or sex glands, which is picked up by any cell carrying the appropriate receptor on its surface. If any hormone does engage its receptor on the cell wall, it has a potent effect on the activities of that cell. When all the receptive cells, perhaps many millions of them, are affected together, the whole body is likely to be significantly affected too. Thus, we find that the thyroid hormones shift the body's use of calories in favour of burning them off as heat, as against burying them in long-term fat stores. Adrenaline shifts blood flow towards the muscles, heart and brain, and away from digestive and other functions, and performs other changes that together adapt the body for the demands of possibly life-saving exercise. The stress hormones or steroids work towards backing the body's reserves after adrenaline has had its say. Now, I'm really itching to say something here. Basically, when we're looking at steroids, we have natural steroids in the body. And I think what tends to happen is that when you're taking conventional medicine, say for arthritis, you are taking steroids on a long-term basis, which creates incredible side effects, when really what we need to be doing is building up the steroids that we have in our own bodies. And in fact, licorice root is an amazing anti-inflammatory herb because it contains natural steroids as well. Continuing on with the article, insulin moves blood sugar into the body's cells so it can be used as an energy store, but is directly opposed by another hormone also produced by the pancreas called glucagon that shuts off sugar access to the bulk of the body's cells so as to keep blood sugar levels high enough to keep the brain supplied with its only source of energy. Hormones also provide the basis for emotional feelings, and this chemical basis explains why such changes seem to come in waves that resist rational instruction. Anger and fear both arise from cocktails of adrenaline and its relatives, and when combined with the stress hormones, a feeling of euphoria is produced. The hormone prolactin, produced especially in late pregnancy and during breastfeeding, induces strong maternal feelings. The thyroid hormone increases nervous tension, and with adrenaline, anxiety. Many might find a chemical basis to emotions and even to the control of body functions slightly disturbing. They might be reassured a little by appreciating that the hormones are simply the main method of internal communication within the body. They are the means by which cells communicate with each other, either on a localized basis or on a grander scale, as in the above examples. Hormones are servants of the body's policies, not masters. They are agents for control, and in only the rare case where the glands itself is deceased do they dictate events on their own. If life were to be compared to riding a horse, the hormone's job would be to keep the body as a whole, as well as its many constituent parts, successfully in the saddle. Everything else that we say about them flows from our understanding this essentially coordinating role. In particular, it is likely to change our ideas about what to do when it seems as though the hormones are misbehaving, but more of that later. Although every cell and tissue in the body is radically influenced by the prevailing hormonal climate in the fluids bathing it, there is one example where the impact of hormonal change is most dramatic: the reproductive system. This is particularly so in that of the woman, where substantial changes are necessary each month as the system prepares itself anew for the possibility of carrying a child. We find as a result that not only is there a new egg released every month, but that every single component of the reproductive apparatus is changed accordingly in preparation for the pregnancy and then back again if no pregnancy ensues. The actual structure of the reproductive tissues is forever changing in a constant flux in direct response to the hormonal changes of the menstrual cycle. Moreover, because pregnancy eventually involves a cooperation of the whole body, we find occurring during the menstrual cycle other shifts in body function and metabolism. Of course, all these changes are carried over and amplified if pregnancy does occur, and then the fact that all these events are hormonally mediated to provides dramatic evidence of the hormone's power. The point of all this, of course, is that menstrual problems and at the periphery, problems of puberty and menopause are extremely common and very often derived from some hormonal fluctuation out of place. Knowing what to do under such circumstances is often difficult. From the point of view of orthodox medicine, there is often little to do, except when hormonal irregularity is so clear-cut that giving the appropriate artificial hormone, such as the contraceptive pill, is indicated. Unfortunately, this is a rather crude therapy, if only because it tends to destabilise the underlying hormonal picture further. All hormone secretion is controlled in part by negative feedback. That is, the secretory gland controls its activity by reference to the amount of hormone already in the circulation. Adding a new hormone from the outside can lead to quite long-term depression of the gland normally producing it. Thus, the decision to prescribe a hormone for therapeutic purposes, whether it is insulin in diabetics, thyroid hormone in myoxemia, steroids in inflammatory disease, or estrogen in menopausal problems, is one that should be taken only when there is no other option. In practice, it is found that it tends to make the underlying problems harder to correct. These comments hold too for the use of hormones for contraceptive purposes. This is all very difficult, as there are fewer contraceptive methods that are dependable and none as convenient as the pill. Yet to prevent a natural ovulation, as this method does, can be nothing but an unnatural influence on the subtle balance that is the body's hormonal system. So, I mean, I think what the article is basically saying, that yes, it is okay to take conventional medicine, but you do need to be exercise care and common sense, because it does interfere with the natural rhythm of estrogen secretion. And often what tends to happen is that a lot of women and a lot of marriages actually break up too, because of the fact that a woman can't become pregnant, and there are a lot of problems with fertility in the woman, and in fact there are lots of aggressive methods that the woman needs to undergo in conventional medicine to have a baby, when really what needs to happen is that we need to correct the estrogen deficiency in the woman. So not only do we need to lift the nutritional status of the woman, but we need to correct the estrogen imbalance. And often, you can eat turmeric. Turmeric is not only a really good liver remedy, but it's also excellent for lifting the nutritional status of both men and women, but it's also good for the uterus as well. Ginger, as I was saying to you before, I was talking to you about ginger. Ginger has many, many indications, but it's also really good for cleansing the uterus. It's quite antiseptic, amongst other things, because herbs have multi purposes. They're not just about treating one organ of the body. I think that I'm going to stop here very soon, and I might end Herbal Pathways very soon. But I hope that I was able to give you a guide on herbal medicine and to look at some of the underlying themes, political, historical, and therapeutic themes that come out through herbal medicine. And there's a lot to consider. So as I was saying, on an ongoing basis, I'll be looking at herbal therapeutics and looking at the properties, actions and uses of herbs, and providing education and knowledge, and also recommending lots of books as well. That's really important. Looking at drying and harvesting of herbs, growing of herbs, and perhaps even recommending books on how to identify herbs as well. Now, Ruckus.
Yes.
Can you read out the flyer for the radio benefit before we go?
Yes, here at the sweatshop capital this colony, otherwise known as Los Angeles of America. There's going to be a benefit for Keel Radio, January the 18th at the Echo. It's 1822 West Sunset Boulevard, 18 and over, $5 cover, and the show starts at 8:30 at night. And it looks like it's going to be a fundraiser for Keel Radio by the Central Second Collective. The band's playing is going to be The Transmissions, Death to Anders, One Track Pony, Anchors for Architects, and Die Rockers Die.
And in the next couple of weeks, when we come back and do the show Behind the Bars of America, we will have an opportunity to bring to you some of the music or samples of the music that will be played for the fundraiser. So, yeah, see if you can turn up at the fundraiser and enjoy, and you'll be raising money for Keel Radio. Keel Radio is an amazing radio station that really tries to work with people that have been grossly underrepresented in the media, such as women, prisoners, black communities, people with disabilities, all people that have been marginalised. Because as we know, our prison industrial complex is full of the poor. Actually, I wonder if they have herbal medicines in prisons. Maybe that's a campaign that we need to embark on at some stage. All right, well, take care, stay safe, and do not stay sick. Until next time, bye.